Welcome to Pop Culture Retro, which was recently voted the 15th best podcast by the residents of the Golden Years Retirement Community in Boca Raton, Florida. Each show, we'll revisit some of your favorite pop culture memories with insider and outsider perspectives. Now, please help me welcome your hosts, Ike Eisenman and Jonathan Rosen.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Pop Culture Retro. I'm one of your hosts, Jonathan Rosen, along with Ike Eisenman. And today we are thrilled to welcome a fantastic entertainer who has headlined cabaret shows, has won awards for his tribute to Carol Channing, is an expert on one of my favorite musicals, Hello Dolly, has hosted the great series Richard Skipper Celebrates, and is also about to host a celebration for 60 years of Hello Dolly in the Laurie Beachman Theater in New York on March 29th, as well as the Revolution Theater in Palm Springs on April 19th, and the Hollywood Club in LA on April 21st. Please help us welcome Richard Skipper. Richard, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. This means a lot to me, so thanks.
Well, we've got a lot to cover, but to start with, you grew up in South Carolina. So was your family very into the arts?
No. An emphatic no. I am a product of 1960s and 70s television. I grew up watching the variety shows from that era. That was the show business that I wanted to be a part of. The Carol Burnett Show. I'm old enough to remember Ed Sullivan. The Hollywood Palace. For anyone who knows anything about that history, it was literally 20 to 30 years after vaudeville that television came along. So those were the kind of variety artists that I grew up watching, that I wanted to be a part of. So I grew up, I don't know how either of you, how old either of you are, but I'm going to assume that I'm the oldest one here. So when I was growing up watching these shows, there were three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. And these three networks vied for the largest demographic that they could possibly get. So therefore, I would see artists of my generation sharing a stage with artists from my parents' generation and artists from my grandparents' generation. And growing up in that kind of environment, I think was the greatest training ground for anyone wanting to go into this type of entertainment. And unfortunately, my theory is the greatest disservice to the entertainment industry, and I'm probably going to watch a lot of heads explode right now, but I think the greatest setback was MTV.
Oh, really?
Because I think MTV geared everything for a specific demographic, and therefore today's kids don't have the exposure to the artist that I did when I was growing up.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't disagree with you about that. I mean, everything, like someone used the term, there's broadcasting and now it's narrowcasting, in terms of content. And it really, so many things do cater to such a smaller audience rather than the widest possible audience. And look, I grew up on those shows as well and absolutely love them. I mean, just love them. I know Jonathan loves them too. He's got a rich history of loving some of the ones I found rather challenging, but hey, but when did you first realize you had a talent for performing?
Well, I being that kid that not only did I watch everything, but I mimicked everything I saw on television.
So
I would go to school on Monday and I would do almost like a recap of everything I saw on television that weekend. But what was great was that because of the world that we lived in at that time, all the kids in school saw the same shows that I saw. So they knew what I was talking about. They knew when I was doing an impersonation of Carol O'Connor or Carol Channing or Carol Burnett or any of the Carols. They knew who these people were because as a collective in this country, And think about this, not to get political for a moment. Everybody got the same news. It wasn't fractured news. My family, I grew up in a Walter Cronkite household. So our family, after dinner, would watch the news. And then we would watch whatever that night's programming was. But I did grow up in a television household. And so I would go to school and I would just imitate anything that I saw on television. And that was the beginnings for me.
Well, speaking of the impressions and the impersonations, you're known as being one of the most prominent Carol Channing impersonators. So when did you
I'm
going to
rephrase
like,
that. I was the most prominent Carol Channing impersonator.
But when did you first realize that you could do an impression of her, and how did it come about?
Well, my introduction to Carol Channing actually came from an episode of The Lucy Show, in which Lucille Ball impersonates Carol Channing. And if you know the episode, she comes in and she does this very broad impression of Carol Channing. And I didn't even realize at that moment that Carol Channing was a real person. I thought she was a cartoon character that Lucille Ball had created. So I began by doing that impression. And then I saw Carol Channing and Pearl Bailey in their television special together. And then I started catching Carol on The Love Boat, The Muppets. Once in a while, she'd make a guest appearance on a show, the talk shows. And I started imitating her. So I would perform, not dressed as her, of course, but just getting on the front steps of our high school and doing these numbers that she was known for. So I moved to New York in August of 1979. There was a place that I used to go to called the Piano Bar, and get up and I would sing as Richard Skipper, and I would get up and do a couple of numbers. And one night I had some friends visiting from South Carolina, and I got up, I performed the two songs, and Houston Allred at the piano said, "Do something else for us." And one of my friends yelled, "Do Carol Channing." And of course, the entire room burst into applause and laughter. And Houston Allred said, "Do you do Carol Channing?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, we would like," my friends talked him into it. I got up, he staged the Dolly number with all the waiters. And I got up, I did Hello Dolly, and I got a standing ovation. I was 19 years old.
Oh, wow.
So a woman comes up to me, she's Leola Harlow, and Leola Harlow said, "What's your drag name?" And I didn't even know what that meant. I was fresh off the turnip truck in South Carolina. I didn't know what drag was. I didn't know that there was a world of drag. I knew nothing about that, nor did I want to do that for my own career. So I got up, I did what I was asked to do. She said she wanted to dress me, and I said, "That's never gonna happen." Well, about 3 months later, I go to an audition for an off-Broadway show. I walk in the door, and they go, "You're Carol Channing," because they had seen me at the Piano Bar. And they had written a role in the show for a character that they wanted to come in and do an impersonation. And they rewrote the role for me. So the show opened. Wow. I got a standing ovation. And they cut the number from the show because they didn't want the show to be about that moment.
Oh my God.
But I had a costume. Wow. And so every year on Halloween, I would go out dressed as Carol and do a few things. And this went on for quite some time. And then in 1990, a show was written called Men of Manhattan. A character was written for me called Carl Channing. I did that. And then shortly after that, when it was announced that Carol was coming back to Broadway to do Hello Dolly, I was talked into doing a show. And that's how it began.
Wow.
Well, are there any other performers you do impressions of?
For a brief moment, I performed as Judy Garland. Everybody
Oh.
did Judy Garland. So, but the issue that I had, first of all, I'm 5'11". Judy was 4'11". So you put me in heels and a wig, I was a giant on stage. Although I did it at the Taj Mahal in Atlantic City. And I did two runs of two shows there as Judy and Carol. But the issue was that with both of these artists, I've always done it with the utmost respect for who they are. And not all, but a lot of impersonators are making fun of their subjects. They are putting them through a lens that they want the audience to experience. And in my case, I never wanted to make fun of Judy or Carol. And as a result, it was very difficult for me to get the traction with Judy that I eventually got with Carol Channing.
Well, speaking of that, that's an interesting thing that you just brought up. So, what was Carol Channing's first reaction when she saw you? When she first saw it, how did she react to it?
Well, for anyone who's watching, there are lots of pictures. All you need to do is Google Richard Skipper and Carol Channing, and pictures will pop up all over the internet. The first chance that I, just as I was getting ready to open my show in New York, I found out that the New York City Gay Men's Chorus and Carol Channing were going to be doing a tribute to Jerry Herman. And I wanted to be a part of that. So I started writing letters. I started, making phone calls. In those days, we didn't have social media, and everything landed on deaf ears. But a friend of mine called me up, and he said that Carol was going to be at the after party, and he was going to be playing, and he wanted to know if I would be available to crash the party as Carol. And I went in, and when Carol saw me, the first, I'm fighting a throat thing as you can hear it, the first thing she said to me was, "How long have you been impersonating me?" And I said, "Well, who's to say you're not impersonating me?" And that was it. And everything she asked me about the work that I was doing, I answered as Carol, not as Richard. And she was amazed at how much research I had done on her. So I opened my show in New York. That took me to Atlantic City, Las Vegas. And for the next 20 years, that was my career.
Well, were you very nervous doing it in front of her?
I was excited, I think, more than nervous. I was prepared. I knew that I was good at what I did. My only thought was, is she going to like it or is she not going to like it? And if she didn't like it, because I really didn't have that much invested in it at that time, I would have walked away from it. I would have said, no, this is not for me. She doesn't like what I'm doing, and I'll go on with my life. But little did I know that not only would that career start, but as you can see from the image behind you, it was the beginning of a 20-year friendship. We were friends for until she passed away.
That's, I was gonna ask this, I'm a huge fan of Carol's as well. So, and you did become friends with her, like you said. So what was she like in general?
She was just a very, she was driven. Her work, she lived, ate, and breathed to be in the theater. The idea of missing a performance or not going on, not being there when someone was expecting her was just absolutely foreign to her. She lived to please an audience and to please the people in her private life as well. If somebody called me up and said, "Do you think you could get me an interview with Carol Channing?" I'd say, "Well, I'll call her and ask her." and she'd say, "Richard, for you, I'll do anything." And a lot of people got interviews that her publicist will hate me for saying this. If they had gone through the publicist, she may not have gotten those interviews.
Mm. Wow. Well, besides you, there have been quite a few people who did impressions or impersonations of her. Did she have any particular ones that she loved or hated? And in general, what did she think of the impersonations?
Well, there's a very funny story. She was doing an interview with Harry, her last husband, and they were doing this interview, and the interviewer said, "Well, Miss Channing, you've been interviewed by so many people in this industry. Who was your favorite?" And she said, "Well, I really don't have a gauge with that because I have to step outside of myself to see what they're doing, and I don't see." And before she could finish, Harry said, "It's Richard Skipper." She said, "Harry, do you really think it's Richard Skipper?" And he said, "Well, of course it's Richard Skipper." She says, "Well, why do you think it's Richard Skipper?" And he says, "Because he loves you." She said, "Well, there you have it."
That's great.
But she would never come out and say that I was her favorite or that I was the best. And there are a lot of people out there who are incredible at what they do. And they're wonderful too. Again, everything that I did came from an absolute love of who she was as an artist. And the interesting thing is, as we got to know each other, I wanted to perform it was because I never felt that I could measure up to the person. And that became harder for me.
Well, getting back to you, you grew up in South Carolina. What made you decide at the time to move to New York, you know, to try to make it when you did?
Well, when I was 13 years old, I was reading a book called The Magic of Believing by Claude M. Bristol. Tells you the kind of kid I was. But I'm reading this book on August 5th, 1974. And in the book, it said, "Set your mind on a goal like a homing pigeon and go after it with dogged determination." And it was almost like I was having this out-of-body experience. A light bulb went off over my head, and I sat there and I read that sentence over and over and over again until it was in my brain. And then I went into my mom and dad and I said, 5 years from today, I'm going to New York. And they both looked at me like I was speaking a foreign language. They didn't, you know, "What do you mean you're going to New York? You don't know anyone in New York. It's not as easy as you." And I said, "I'm going to go." So every year on August 5th, I would say 4 years from today,
what?
3 years from today. And even until I was packing to go, my parents didn't think I would actually do it. And the day that I left home, the last thing my father said to me as I got on the plane was, "We'll see you in 3 weeks."
Wow.
Jeez. And that was 45 years ago.
Wow.
Well, moving away from home is a scary proposition, especially
scary
going from somewhere like South Carolina to a place like New York. I mean, were there times when you were there and just wondering, you know, what am I doing here?
Every single night. No, I came to New York. The New York that I imagined was the New York of Breakfast at Tiffany's, Sunday in New York. And the New York that I ended up in the middle of was Midnight Cowboy and Taxi Driver.
Oh, my God.
And I have to tell you, when I watch those movies now, I get nostalgic. Because there was a grittiness to what New York was like at that time. Mm-hmm. But to be 18 years old, to be on your own in a city like New York, I got my first job the next day, $6 an hour as a messenger. You live frugally. You learn how to economize. And you just learn as you go along, because there's no guidelines for doing it.
By the same token, I said, not to regret, but How long did it take you to first feel comfortable? And, you know, was there any moment that stood out when you said this was the right thing to do?
Well, I'm going to be a little honest with everybody right now. I grew up in an alcoholic household. My father was an alcoholic. And if any of you have experienced that world, you live on eggshells. You never know from day to day what the situation was going to be. And my father, for the first, and I speak lovingly of him, but for the first 15 years of my life, every weekend was almost a nightmare to live through. And so when years later, you know, when he passed away, I said that coming from that background, and there are a lot of people who will think I'm off my rocker when I say this, but I think it was a gift, because if I had come from a nurturing background, I would have been home within 3 weeks. So no matter how bad things got in New York, and I went from roommate situation to roommate situation, I was ripped off by roommates. I was almost evicted because I had been paying a roommate cash and he had been spending it. You know, going through all of that, it was like, you know, as you go on, as in life, you make friends, you make connections. And I started building a family for myself here in New York. And I wouldn't trade anything for anything. It's just been a growth experience. And now, you know, when did, you know, I become comfortable? That's a good question. I don't know. I was just too busy getting through it all.
Jeez. Well, you mentioned your first job was as a messenger. What were some of your other early jobs or gigs in New York?
Singing telegrams, which was one of my favorite jobs. I sang for Liza Minnelli. For Dustin Hoffman. I sang for Bob Guccione. And when you are doing singing telegrams, you can do anything, because you never know what you're going into, and they're not expecting you. So I would go into a restaurant or a theater or someone's private home and be able to win them over. And when you do that, you can do anything. Wow. I worked for an answering service. And remember those?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I worked for an answering service. I did temp work. I did whatever I could do to survive.
Let's talk about Hello, Dolly. It's one of my favorite musicals. Now, I was reading that the Carol Channing version is not the first one that you saw.
No. The first time that I saw a full production of Dolly was the movie when it was first shown to television. I think that was 1971 that they sold the rights to CBS. And that was the first time that I saw the full production or the storyline as we know it. The first time that I saw it on stage, I did a production of Dolly shortly after I moved to New York, played Barnaby Tucker, and then seeing Carol Channing on Broadway. I think that was the first time that I saw a professional production of it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
was in 1997.
What did you love about the musical when you first heard it or saw it?
Well, first of all, I'm a huge fan of Jerry Herman. I love the music. I love the storyline. It's really about taking chances. I mean, when you think about Cornelius and Barnaby wanting to get out of Yonkers, where they've lived their entire lives. They've never been in New York City. They want a day of adventure. And I did it. I did that. That is something that truly gravitated towards me. And then, you know, it's about love. It's about falling in love. It's about the possibility of just taking those chances and seeing how it will unfold. That those are the core messages that resonate with me.
Well, you know, speaking of Dolly, you know, you have this great website, callondolly.com, which is dedicated to all things Hello Dolly and its history. So I was going through it this weekend, and let's take a look at some of the names who have played the role. I mean, besides Carol Channing, it was, you know, Pearl Bailey, Barbara Streisand, Madeline Kahn, Dorothy L'Amour, Bette Midler. It just goes on and on. How many of the iterations have you seen, and do you have any particular favorites?
There are a lot of, you know, I've seen Nancy Opel, and I love that in Washington, D.C. I saw Andrea McArdle play Dolly. Bette Midler. I loved Bette Midler as Dolly. Bette Midler, Donna Murphy was a favorite. Bernadette Peters, hoping to go to London this summer to see Imelda Staunton. So some are better singers, some are better actresses, some are better dancers, some are better that Dolly needs, but they all have something unique to bring to the table.
Well, I personally love the movie musical with Barbara Streisand. Mm-hmm. And growing up in the 70s, that's the one I actually knew first, right, well before right. I had any idea that it had been a stage musical. And I've read different things about the movie. So we're so glad we have a Hello Dolly expert on. Did Carol Channing want to do the movie, or she wasn't asked?
She wasn't asked.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, the joke that Carol used to say was that she was on the first floor of a hotel in Chicago, and even though it was the first floor, she almost jumped out the window. another joke that she would tell is the only time she ever got airsick was being on a plane, and the in-flight movie was Hello Dolly. She was very disappointed that she didn't get the chance. When Barbara Streisand signed her contract with Ray Stark to do Funny Girl, the movie, she signed a three-picture deal. And the three pictures were Hello Dolly, Funny Girl, and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. Mm-hmm. And although a lot of other actresses had been talked about, Doris Day was talked about, Betty Grable, Elizabeth Taylor was even mentioned at one point, that they would dub her singing. So there were a lot of different ideas that were being bandied about, but I don't think that any other actress had a chance. It was going to be Barbara Streisand. And the biggest thing, you know, she was 27 when she did it.
Thank you.
Carol Channing was 41 when she did it originally on Broadway. So a lot of people are constantly thinking Barbara Streisand was too young to play this role. But when you think...
I've read that a lot, by the way.
What was that?
I've read that a lot.
You read it a lot, but the fact of the matter is, number one, we don't know how old she was when she married Ephraim Levi. She could have been a child bride. He could have died shortly into the marriage. And going into a severe depression, as one would have, losing a mate that you are madly in love with, could have kept her away from their favorite restaurant for a few years. So all of those things that people say are implausible, I find them plausible. And as much as I love Carol Channing and every other actress, nobody could sing those songs like Barbara Streisand.
That's a great movie. Did Carol ever watch the full movie or no?
She would say that she didn't, but I'm sure she did. You know, it's very interesting. Carol used to say that she never saw any other actress play Dolly except for Pearl Bailey. And yet when Carol passed away, they found scrapbooks full of her clippings of the other Dollies and her notes by each of those clippings.
Well, what are your thoughts on the film in comparison to the show?
I love both. There are songs that are in the show. I mean, you see behind you Lorna Dallas. She's my guest this week. And we had a rehearsal yesterday, and she's singing a song from the movie called Love Is Only Love. Beautiful rendition that she does of that. And she's also singing Ribbons Down My Back. But there were songs that were put in the movie. There were songs that were cut out of the Broadway show that were more in keeping with Carol Channing and the other actresses who followed her. But the movie, it's to me, is a unique version of the film, of the story. And I think as time has gone on, more and more audiences respect the movie now with a little history behind us than they did at the time that it opened.
So I've read conflicting reports on the relationship between Barbra Streisand and Walter Matthau and Barbra Streisand and Gene Kelly, who directed it. So for years I'd always known that there was like they hated each other, but lately I've been reading that that may have been overblown. Do you know anything on those the history of that film?
Have you read Barbara's latest biography?
I've not yet, so.
She talks about her relationship with Gene Kelly and Walter Matthau. The problem was, when Barbra Streisand did the movie, opened, and or they started production for the movie before Funny Girl opened. So Barbra Streisand was a household name because of television, but she was not a bona fide movie star. So when she was signed on to do the show, she asked for a certain salary and she got it. And she asked for certain perks because she had a baby and she got it. She wasn't trying to be difficult or a diva or a star. These were things that she asked for and she got. Ziggy, stop. My alarm went off. But Walter Matthau, who was a more established star, was incredibly jealous of the fact that she was being treated this way. And he took it out on her. And he, but once the cameras were rolling, I mean, he would yell, asides to her off camera. But once the camera was rolling, they were both very professional. In the case of Gene Kelly, Gene Kelly snapped at an extra or something one day, and Barbara chastised him on it in front of the company. And that created a rift between the two of them. The other thing is that when Gene Kelly was signed on to do the movie, he wanted, did you ever see The Matchmaker?
I've seen The Matchmaker, yes.
With Shirley Booth?
Yes.
He wanted to do a movie that was more in keeping with that. He thought to do Hello, Dolly the way that he wanted to do it, it would have been a very intimate, small musical. But it was Danick and Ernest Liebman and the powers that be at 20th Century Fox that made it bigger and bigger and bigger. And this, and so Gene Kelly often said that the film that came out was not the film that he intended to make. And you look at the parade scene, for example, thousands of extras. No parade has ever had that many people. It just got bigger and bigger and bigger. Also, when they started production on the film, the Broadway show was still running. And they had a contract that they could not open the film as long as the show was still running on Broadway. But the film
Nice.
sat in a vault for 2 years. And they
And all
realized that the show could go on for many, many years. So when the film opened in 1969, it was the year of Midnight Cowboy. It was a different audience.
Yeah.
And so, even though the film did very well, there are people out there to this day who said that it was a flop. It was not a flop. And it was nominated for 8 Academy Awards.
I can't even imagine it smaller like an internet. I can't even picture it
No.
like that.
No.
Good grief. Well, Carol Channing was so intertwined with the role. Mm-hmm. And I know some actors wind up, you know, having this love-hate relationship with their most famous roles just because they wish people would see them in other things that they did. Was Carol ever like that?
No. As a matter of fact, if she exhumed today, she would go on the road and do it again. she never tired of it. She did over 5,000 performances. And I've had the luxury, as you can see from the website, of interviewing so many people who worked with her. And every single person said, no matter what was going on in her personal life or the world, when she stepped on that stage every night and she got that applause, it was like a shot of adrenaline right through her. And she was always there 150% with every single performance. She loved it. She lived for it.
Well, you mentioned you also got to interview Jerry Herman. So what was he like, and how did that interview come about?
Well, 10 years ago, I put together a brunch at Sardi's here in New York, celebrating the 50th anniversary. And I've been trying to get an interview with Jerry for a long, long time. And nothing, it was never happening. So the night before the brunch, and we had people coming in from all of the various companies, the night before the brunch, I get a phone call from Jerry Herman. And he said, thank you for what you've done for this musical. If you did not care as much as you cared, there are people that would probably think that it was a forgotten musical. So thank you. And by the way, when are we going to do that interview? I said, Jerry, I said, whenever you want to do it. He said, and he was under the weather. He was in failing health. He said, I'll make it happen. So one day out of the blue, I get a phone call and he said, are you ready for that interview? I'm in a good mood today. So we sat down and he was just the way that you imagine him, from MAME and Mrs. Santa Claus and Hello, Dolly. That's who he was. And, you know, we stayed in touch until he passed away.
Well, what are some other fun facts about Hello, Dolly that the average fan wouldn't know?
Well, I don't know if you'd call them fun facts, but just to give you a little bit of the trajectory of the show, when they first previewed in Detroit and they opened on March 18th, 1963. Kennedy was assassinated.
Yeah.
And that put a pall over the entire production. You know, do we move forward with trying to create a musical about happy times in the midst of a mourning country? Their next stop was the National Theater in Washington, D.C. And Kennedy and Jackie were supposed to be there on opening night. And they were friends of Carol Channing's. So it opened against that backdrop. Shortly after this opened, Louis Armstrong has a hit record with Hello, Dolly. That knocked the Beatles off the charts. And because of the success of that album, that song, audiences were flocking to New York to see it. Again, in the world of no social media. And then when Mary Martin did the international company, it was supposed to go to Russia, and it was supposed to be the first Russian-American company. And the Russian government said they did not want this show in Russia because of the United States involvement with the Vietnam War. And so David Merrick, the producer, said, if you don't want us in Russia because of the Vietnam War, we'll take it to Vietnam. And they took the show to Vietnam.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. Well, you've interviewed many people. You mentioned from the original Broadway cast. I've tried to get people from the film on our stage. Have you ever spoken to any of them?
I have. I've interviewed Marion McAndrews, who played Irene Molloy in the film. I've interviewed Judy Nayes, who is also, she plays Gussie Granger in the film. I reached out to Michael Crawford, and he said, "It's all in my book." He said, "Nothing more to say." I've interviewed those. Patricia Kelly, who was married to Gene Kelly, shared his notes with me, and
Oh,
that was
nice.
great. So as far as the movie, those are my connections.
Well, we had on, I mentioned you when I first started talking to you. We've had on Carol Demas, who you're good friends with, and she's lovely. So she was the first one who got me into your show, Richard Skipper Celebrates. You know, fantastic show. You got him to interview so many greats from the theater. So many who I'm a fans of. So you've done almost 900 episodes. So how did that start? How did that come about?
COVID.
That
COVID. When everything shut down. Leslie Ann Warren is a friend of mine. And I wanted Leslie to do the show. I had thought about doing a podcast, just like a radio show. And then someone suggested that I do a live video stream like this. So the first person I reached out to was Leslie Ann Warren, and she said yes. And she was going to be coming to New York to do an event. And we got together to talk about that. And then it snowballed. Somebody would say, "Well, you should interview this person," or "Have you interviewed this person?" And it would just go on and on and on. And that's how it all began.
Well, who was your most difficult get?
My most difficult get. I'm doing the show in, I have guests on the show, my live show. I'm doing my celebration of Hello Dolly in Hollywood on the 21st of April. And I have been trying to get an interview with this woman for years and years and years. And she has turned me down for well over 10 years in interviews.
That's what.
She just would not do it. And last week, I got a call from her, and she said, "I want to do your show here in LA." And it's Joanne Worley.
Oh,
Oh, wow.
And I flown for a loop. Richard, what are you wearing?
Oh, we're big fans of hers as well. Yeah. So, are there any that were on your wish list that never materialized?
The ultimate would be Barbra Streisand.
Okay.
I mean, that is the absolute ultimate. And I've reached a point now with putting my emphasis on doing live work again, that I'm not really pursuing any interviews. If a publicist reaches out to me and says, "Would you have this person on the show?" then I will, do it if it fits into my schedule. I've been very fortunate. Barbra Streisand, I would say, is right up there. I really wanted to interview Cheetah Rivera. And Cheetah Rivera was a neighbor. She was a friend. But for some reason, it just never happened. And
So
that's a big regret of mine.
we reached out to Cheetah Rivera's people as well, and which so we're told also like to check back. She's busy now, and then it never the same thing.
So that was a big disappointment for me. There will come a time where certain people that you've had on your show will pass away. And I don't know if that's happened yet, but it will happen.
Got a
And
couple,
so, so, and when I look at Sarah Dash, Anita Pointer, and a few others that I've had on the show, I am grateful that I've got this that's saved. It's in their own words. It's their story. It's not a fabrication of their story. That makes it all worthwhile for me. And I'm always thrilled when that happens, that I've got those interviews, that are saved there.
We feel it's the same here very much. We had that happen a couple of weeks ago with someone actually, and that video of all of a sudden surged right after.
Well, you were friends with most of the performers you interviewed. Did you still learn surprising things from them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I once said that I should write a book on how to maintain a career through the eyes of Carol Channing, because she was the ultimate professional. Again, before social media and everything, her husband, she would have these yellow legal pads. They kept notes of every person who interviewed them, and they would remember things about them. And they would, anytime she would show up in a town, they would send an invitation to those reporters to come and see a show. She maintained these relationships, and she was the best at it.
Well, you may have already kind of answered this, but any plans to do more of that?
Oh yeah, there. As I said, I want to get to London this summer. I would hope to interview Imelda Staunton about what her take is on Dolly. I read an article the other day where she said that a lot of people are asking her if she's playing Dolly Parton because people don't know the
Wow.
showrunner Dolly.
That's
And
amazing to
again,
me.
it goes back to where we began. We've all been exposed to it, but it's a universal show, but there are a lot of people who don't know the show.
Well, we're recording this now in late March. And as we stated at the top, this Friday, March 29th, you're going to be doing a show at on the 60th anniversary of Hello Dolly at the Beachman Theater. And you're going to have two shows in California in April. So you have, going to Dallas now, and we mentioned Joanne Worley, who also we're big fans of. So tell us about your show itself and what can people expect?
Well, I tell the history of the show. Before the show starts, my stage manager passes questions cards out to the audience, and then those cards are screened. I don't see them before the show, but they'll put what they think are the best questions, maybe new questions that I have not talked about before. And so at various intervals in the show, I take questions from the audience. I show film clips from the people who become friends of mine about what their experience was doing Dolly. I sing a lot of the songs from the show. It's a very audience interactive, let's have a great time celebration. And my hope is to take this around the country. So
That's what we're going to ask then. We're hoping so.
call your favorite venue and request.
Well, how can people get tickets?
They can go to the Laurie Beachman website. They can go to the Revolution Stage Company in Palm Springs and Hollywood Club LA in Los Angeles.
What would it take to take the show on the road? I mean, is there interest at all that you've seen?
Yes, I've got a lot of irons on the fire right now, and it's just a matter of scheduling and fitting it into their schedule. And getting it out there.
Well, you have been working on a book about the history of Hello Dolly. What's the status on that?
I have put that on hold because I want to get more and more of the live work out there. That's my heart and soul. And once, that gets rolling, I'm going to get back to the book.
What do you think it is about Hello Dolly that has led to its longevity and, its enduring appeal?
It's like The Wizard of Oz or Mary Martin's Peter Pan or certain things that have a nostalgic pull on us from certain points in our life. And the thing about this show, as I mentioned earlier, taking chances and love, everybody's experienced it. And I think that it takes us back to those moments.
Well, you mentioned you are going to get back to the book, but after this is done, is there anything else you're working on next?
Who knows?
Well,
I don't know.
How can people follow you on social media?
Google me, Richard Skipper. I'm easy to find. I joke about this because there is a senator in South Carolina, and we're on opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to our politics. But his name is Richard Skipper as well. So I can only imagine what people experience when they Google him. Because I'm going to show up first in the search engines.
Well, Richard, we want to thank you so much for coming on.
Thank
it was
you
such
so
a
much.
Treat. I was looking forward to this. Like I said, when I first spoke to you, I'd been a fan of the video series. And again, and I'm going to thank, if she watches, Carol Demas for pointing it out to begin with.
Carol, I love her. I love her. I love her. And she's still going strong.
Yes, she is. But we want to thank you again. And welcome back anytime. And we'd love to have you anytime.
Thank you. Same here. Thank you so much.
Again, this has been Pop Culture Retro. I'm Jonathan Rosen with Ike Eisenman. And again, a very special thanks to Richard Skipper. And please like, comment, and subscribe.
Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Retro, where no one was hurt during the making of this podcast.